We're in 2 Thessalonians, and we're in chapter 2, and we were studying in part of verse 13 last time about the issues of obligation and grace, because Paul said we're obligated to give thanks, which giving thanks is the word itself means to respond to grace given or extended. So when you're obligated to do something that was graciously done to you, it creates all kinds of problems for lots of people simply because grace is not supposed to be related to our performance, in theory. So we were trying to explain our way through that whole issue of obligation in relation to grace, and we got down to the fact that Paul apparently felt like God's choice of them from the beginning in verse 13, middle of the verse, for salvation meant that they were people that he had actually been assigned to get the gospel to, because he was the apostle to the Gentiles for the progress of the gospel, and people, when they came to know Christ through whatever efforts he had made, he felt obligated to God to thank him for that, because in a very real sense, God is doing his job for him. He was supposed to be the apostle of the Gentiles, but all he really had to do was make sure the message was out there, because you can't really convince anybody of the truth. God has to do that, and he did in this case. So this evening what we're going to do is pick up there in verse 13. We want to pursue this idea of why Paul was obligated to give thanks. In a very short summary, we argued last time that grace doesn't eliminate obligation. It just provides a different way of having that obligation met. In other words, God requires perfect obedience from human beings because they're his creatures and they owe him perfect obedience with no arguments. But that's not what he gets. And so, requiring that means that if they approach him on the basis of those requirements, he will have to judge them as failures. And judgment for failure in the eyes of a holy God means some pretty bad things. Therefore, grace stepped into the picture and gave us the Son of God to become a second Adam so that he could do in our place, for our sake, what God required of us. He did, and then God will give us what Jesus accomplished on our behalf when we put our trust in him, because that's the promise. I'll give you eternal life if you put your trust in my son, Jesus. So God met the requirement by grace, and the obligation was met because Jesus didn't fail to do that. He perfectly fulfilled all the obligation, and in a very real sense, it carries over in the Christian life, too. God, in a very real sense, lays a lot of obligations on his children because they're his children. They're supposed to act like his children. And yet, who of us does always do everything God tells us to do as one of his kids? And the answer is none of us, and therefore the obligation's there. So how is it met? Well, in the New Testament methodology, the Spirit of God will produce the fruit of the Spirit through our bodies if we'll just trust him. And when we trust him, he gives us the credit for having accomplished what he, in effect, is actually doing. So grace just provides a new way of obligation meeting. In the old law, you were obligated, and so you had to do it however you could do it. Under the New Testament, promise is there. You trust the promise, you get the credit for the accomplishment, even though it's not yours. It's Jesus's or the Spirit's. But in the background of all this grace obligation terminology, we read in verse 13 that the reason Paul felt obligated was because God had chosen them from the beginning for salvation through sanctification by the Spirit and faith in the truth. And that's what we're going to camp on this evening. We're going to look into Paul's explanation of how the details of salvation actually become our experience, because God chose these Thessalonians from the beginning for salvation, but that's not where Paul stops. He says, through sanctification by the Spirit and faith in the truth. And that's a really interesting way of translating that, because the word through is actually the Greek word in, which typically means in, with, by, and maybe one or two other things. It's really a general word. And then they translate by the Spirit and faith in the truth. And the by the Spirit is a genitive of the Spirit. And faith in the truth is exactly the same. The word truth is a genitive of the word truth. And what I mean by that is grammatical. But the fact is, sanctification of spirit and faith of truth is the way it ought to be translated, simply because the phrases are exactly alike grammatically, and yet the translator decided to turn one of them into sanctification by the Spirit and the other one in faith in the truth. Well, if it's by in one phrase, it ought to be by in the other. It's exactly the same phrase, and it's in the same verse. It's in the same sentence. So that's where we're headed. What we want to do is understand, if we can, this whole issue of how God decides how things are going to be done and then implements it in history. We know, for example, that, well, in fact, I heard a sermon this morning out of Daniel chapter 11, verses 1 through 35, and the preacher said there are 135 prophecies in those 35 verses of chapter 11, and all 135 of them were fulfilled in history after they were written down by Daniel and before we came on the scene. 135 prophecies in 35 verses, every one of them historically accurate to the point. And all that means is that God has never relinquished his control over his creatures. His creation is following a pattern and a plan that he set in motion a long time ago. Now, the plan does include, when we looked at verse 7 and 8, the mystery of the lawlessness and how he's permitting that to work and has been for 6,000 years, but he's going to permit it forever. There's an end to all of this, a good end. But when we talk about prophetic utterance, this thing about God choosing somebody from the beginning is nothing more than just another one of those things where God has decided ahead of time how it's going to be, and then he told them how it's going to be. The difference is, with this choice of individuals from the beginning, is he hadn't passed out the list. So we don't know who's the chosen one, who's not, and all that. And it's not up to us to know. Our job is not to try to figure out who's chosen and who's not. Our job is to make sure the truth is out there. And Paul actually said in 2 Timothy, everything he suffered for those who were God's chosen. But that means he suffered a lot of things at the hands of a whole lot of people. And he did it all because God has this plan and he's working on it. So what I want us to understand is that in this text, verse 13, the main issue, the reason why Paul feels obligated to give thanks to God for the Thessalonians, brethren beloved by the Lord, is because God chose some human beings from the beginning unto salvation. That's what he says. And the choice is rooted in grace. It's really interesting. The doctrine of God's choosing of people is typically called election. And in Ephesians chapter 1, it says that you were chosen in him from the foundation of the world to the praise of the glory of his grace. Which means this, that you don't understand grace unless you embrace election. And the question is, why? Why can't you understand grace without that? Well, that's because the essence of grace. Grace is God choosing to do good things without being compelled to do them because somebody earned it. And the only way you can take the human element out of the picture is to have the decisions made before those people can be in the picture. That's why in Romans 9 it says, before, when Jacob and Esau were born, before they were ever born, the parents were told the elder will serve the younger. And Paul's explanation is, before they ever did anything good or bad, God just said it. That's the way it's going to be. So, that's the issue of grace. When God says, look, you all deserve to perish because your behavior is sinful, and regardless of all excuses, it's not good behavior, it's pathetic behavior. Therefore, you deserve to be penalized forever. But, grace says, well, I don't want to penalize them. I want to, according to this verse, I want to save at least some of them. And so, That's what he decided to do, save some. And the objective is called salvation. Now, that's a big word. I don't mean spelling-wise, but I mean it covers a lot of area. In the scriptures, salvation is a huge topic because there are so many things that are threatening us, that threaten the quality of our experience. And any time we're delivered from something that threatens the quality of our experience, we are being saved from that. If you fall off a pier into a pond and you can't swim and somebody reaches down and grabs your collar and jerks you back out up so you can breathe, you have just been saved from drowning. Well, the scriptures talk about salvation both at that level, the physical life thing, but it also talks a lot about the spiritual realms. And the spiritual realms have to do with things that have to do with your spirit and your soul as well as your body. And God has a plan involved from the beginning for salvation. So the whole issue is salvation. Now, why does God want us to be saved? Well, bottom line, he wants us to experience the joy of life. That's his reason. God's goal is to enable human beings to experience the joy of life. If he didn't want that, he wouldn't bother about saving us. I'm going to start a study on, we're going to kick it off with the Eaton meeting, so it means I won't really start Tuesday, but this coming Tuesday we're going to start a series called Developing Perspective, or Developing a Biblical Perspective. And one of the first things that I'm going to ask is, why do we have a Bible? And the bottom line, and I'm not going to give it in 5 minutes because I have to take 45 minutes or an hour to teach it, but you get the bottom line is, God wants us to experience the joy of life. If he didn't, he wouldn't have said a thing. We have a Bible because here's the information that we need to have. And if God didn't want us to have this information, if he wanted us to perish, if he wanted us to suffer the consequences of our ill-considered choices and all that, he just wouldn't have said anything. He'd have just let us do it, and then he'd have hammered us. So he gave us a Bible so we know some truth, information. And that's where we get into this sanctification of spirit and faith in of truth. Those are the two issues. In other words, the big issue is God bringing a person to salvation. The secondary issues are how he goes about it. And I think I can say this without too much fear of contradiction, though I am arguing off of the base of my own experience. But I think that most of us who have been saved can look back before we were saved and see some things that God did to bring this point in our experience to happen. I mean, as a kid, I was raised in a moral home, and my mom especially focused on getting us to go to church and that kind of thing while we were small, and we grew up basically going to church on a semi-regular basis. And then as we got older, the requirements of going to church with mom and dad began to drop off when we hit our teenage years, and they said something to this effect: we really think you ought to go to church, but we're going to leave that up to you as to where you go and that kind of thing. So one of my older brothers and I decided that we would shop around for a church that had some good-looking girls in it and go there. So that's what we did. We shopped around, and then one day my mom and aunt said, you know, you ought to try this new church we've been going to. You might enjoy it. So we thought, well, go there. There's some good-looking girls probably in Sunday school. So that's what we did. Those are a few of the background things that brought us to the point where we actually walked into a church where the Bible was explained and the gospel was made clear. And our family heard that. And every person in our family came to know the Lord, except my mom. She was already a believer. But everybody else became a believer because God had orchestrated a whole bunch of stuff in our lives to bring us to this point where we could hear the gospel and his spirit could open our understanding to make it happen or to enable us to see it. So all I'm saying is, God's involved in the details of life. I don't think most people think about it, but there's a little molecule vibrating around the planet Pluto. This is one of considerable jillion trillions of molecules vibrating there. But if you were to go and have a conversation with that little molecule and ask it what its purpose in life was, it would probably say, I haven't got a clue. All I do is sit here and go like this for all my life. And yet, God is just as much a God of the details of the molecules as He is the vastness of the space. In fact, you can take an atom and split it, and you better jump back when you do, because there's enough energy there that's going to burn you and probably ruin your eyesight. That's one atom. But if we take and split enough of those atoms all at the same time, we'll have an atomic bomb. And they've already proven they can build atomic bombs big enough to blow up everything out of molecules, atoms that are here, that are very, 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 very small, but have enormous impact if you mess with them wrong. Well, in that respect, I believe that God has kind of put human beings right in the middle of immensity. So if you look up, you see stars and galaxies, and if you get a big enough telescope and get it far enough out there, you'll just see light years and light years and light years and light years away. And you get the feeling that you're pretty tiny in view of immensity. But in the same way, if you go from here down and use an electron microscope and a few other things and get down below quarks and all those kind of things, you can go an infinite direction in smallness too. And most of us don't even know how far that can go. I mean, we've got a telescope in space to tell us that there's a lot of stuff out there. But our capacity to grasp what's small is limited by our senses and our sight and the machines we can make to. And so we have these theoretical physicists that speculate that this and this and this must be there because of the way things are working, and they can't find it, but it's got to be there. Well, all that is little stuff. Well, God's a God of the big stuff and the little stuff, and He's kind of put us in here, and we're woefully ignorant. Our brains are only, the size of a softball or something like that, and they're only capable of holding a certain amount of information, and once they get full, then everything starts falling out, and then you forget. So, all I'm saying is, God has this huge plan, and He's in control of all of it, and part of that plan is bringing individuals that He has selected from the beginning to a point where they can come to know the joy of His life by being saved from all of the consequences of their bad choices and terrible actions. That's His goal. So how does it happen? Well, Paul uses two phrases. The translators give us their understanding of the phrases, but their understanding doesn't follow the grammar. Because it's through, they say, sanctification by the Spirit and faith in the truth. But the word that's translated through is actually the word in, E-N. And there is a Greek word for through. It's called dia. And if Paul had wanted to write dia, he would have. And then we'd have translated through, and then we'd have had a right translation here. And so you got to wonder, now why did they translate it through when it's actually in, which can be translated in with, by means of, and a few other things. It's a very general word. It's kind of like our word, I-N. There are all kinds of ways we use it. So, there is this E-N translated through in all of its ambiguous glory. The translators don't know what to do with E-N a lot of the time because it's used so many different ways. And then, there's this exact parallel in the grammar of the two phrases. The word sanctification is a dative. And if you're not into grammar, don't worry about it. But it's a dative with the word spirit in the genitive. These are cases in Greek. And then there is the word faith, which is a dative. And it's followed by a genitive of the word truth. Now, all I said that for was so that you'll understand that sanctification is in the dative, which is tied to the E-N, and it's followed by a genitive. And the word faith is a dative, and it's followed by the word truth in a genitive. That means the parallel is exact. The grammar is exactly that. So what we have to do is figure out what in the world is he talking about when he says, literally, in sanctification of spirit and faith of truth. The sanctification of spirit might make some sense, but what does faith of truth mean? That doesn't even make sense in English. And that's why the translators went with it like they did, trying to make it make sense. But the reason for our Bible study is so it'll make more sense. Okay? Now, I want you to go, this idea of sanctification, I want you to go back to 1 Thessalonians for just a jiff and look at chapter 4. Because in verse 3 of chapter 4 of 1 Thessalonians, it's the first letter he wrote them, and then he wrote this second one a little bit later. But he says, this is the will of God, your sanctification. Okay? So sanctification's already been in the mix here. And then in verse 7 of that same chapter, it says, God has not called us for the purpose of impurity, but in sanctification. So sanctification's is in the mix. It's already there. And in chapter 5 of 1 Thessalonians, verse 23, it says, now may the God of peace himself sanctify you. So we got sanctification, sanctify. And now over here in chapter 2, verse 13, we have salvation in sanctification. And we have to understand two things. What does the EN mean? And what is sanctification? It's a big word. But what does it really mean? It's also interesting in light of the parallel grammar that in the majority of texts in 1 Thessalonians regarding faith, in 1 Thessalonians, there's 8 references to faith, and 6 of them, the issue is your faith. And this is followed in 2 Thessalonians with 5 more references to faith, and 4 of them are tied to faith as a human response. So the reason I point that out is because I want you to understand something about sanctification of faith in this verse. I believe that God is bringing people to salvation, and then there's 2 issues involved. One of them is sanctification, and the other is faith. Okay? Now, sanctification is God's side of it. This is the will of God, your sanctification. 1 Thessalonians 5:23, now may the God of peace himself sanctify you. So sanctification is God's side. Faith is our side. So there are 2 issues involved in coming to salvation. One of them is an issue called sanctification. The other is an issue called faith. But those are both qualified. Sanctification is qualified by the genitive of the word spirit, and faith is qualified by the genitive of the word truth. So what's going on here seems to be this. Paul is explaining how salvation occurs in the life of an individual by looking at what God does on his part and what man's response is on his part. And the 2 parts together bring you to salvation. You are delivered from the consequences of your sins, and you're given the promise of eternal life. And when you die, you go to heaven, and no tears there, no sorrow, no nothing, no bad stuff there. Lots of fantastic good stuff. So, when we look at it that way, what we see is what Paul is doing is he's telling us how this happens. That helps us to understand the word EN that's translated through. Since he's explaining how salvation comes to pass, I would translate this way. God has chosen you from the beginning for salvation by means of, in other words, your salvation is by means of this thing called sanctification of spirit and this thing called faith of truth. So that's how it happens. Now, that means that we have to understand what sanctification is. 1 Thessalonians says, it's the will of God, your sanctification. And God has called us to sanctification. And God himself is going to sanctify us. So the whole issue here is that the conclusion we have to draw in terms of translation issues is Paul is deliberately dealing with how God's choice of us for salvation actually comes to pass in our personal history. As far as the records show, and as far as we could figure out after I came to know the Lord, I was saved on Sunday morning in Sunday school class on October the 25th, 1964. But that's when it happened. What had been happening before that was part of the process. There are two things I remember real distinctly after the fact. One of them was several years before that event occurred, I was sitting in the back row of a church that was having communion, and I didn't understand communion, and I didn't know what was going on in church. I didn't pay attention. I got in trouble in Sunday school for talking too much because I wasn't paying attention. But I was sitting on the back row of this church, and they were going to have communion, and I sat there, and you were supposed to pray when you're sitting there. So I bowed my head, and I said to God, "I don't want to go to hell when I die." Where'd that thought come from? But I remember saying it, and I meant it. I did not want to go. I had the idea that the way you got out to going to hell when you died is God is going to ask you some trick question when you died, and if you could answer it right, he'd let you into heaven. That was just a goofy idea I had, but I was just a kid. But nonetheless, I remember saying that to God. And then the year just before I came to know the Lord, I went on a little party for a senior that was graduating that year down to Padre Island, which we only lived about 45 minutes from there. And there were six of us, three girls and three guys, and we were having fun on the beach, swimming in the surf. And the guy that the party was thrown for, who was graduating that year, drowned that day in the surf. And I was the one who pulled his body up out of the surf onto the sand, and when I had my arm wrapped around his chest holding on to him, the salt water was just bubbling out of his mouth and his nose, and he was dead. I've never touched a dead body in my life. It's a terrifying experience. And I stood there on the beach while the guy's girlfriend was trying to do artificial respiration, trying to get him to come back to life, and I stood there praying, "God, if you'll bring him back to life, I'll do anything you want me to." I was bargaining. But it rattled my cage. I didn't know the guy. I knew I was involved in the party because the guy's girlfriend was a real close girlfriend to the girl that invited me to go, so she'd have a partner in the party. So that was how I was connected. I wasn't emotionally involved with that guy, but goodness. So, it sobered me. And that fall, I came to know the Lord. So these are just things in the background that I look back on and I see God wanted me to come to the joy of life, and he was orchestrating the experiences of my life so that my mind and my heart would be right when it came time. When I heard the gospel and understood it and was asked if I would put my trust in Christ. I believe that's what Paul's talking about here. But he calls it sanctification of spirit, faith of truth. What does that mean? Well, as I've already said, sanctification is God's part. But what is sanctification, really? It comes from the Greek word hagiazo, and it has to do with most of the time, well, let me say it this way. The word translated sanctification is used 10 times in the New Testament, okay? 5 of those times it's translated sanctification. Guess what it's translated as? The other 5. Holiness. Now, I have a real problem with translators that do this to me. I mean, why are you going to translate sanctification 5 times when I don't even know what that is? And holiness the other 5 times and I don't even know what that is? Be consistent. That's my whole appeal. But they don't. The point, though, is I had to go looking for what this word means. And by and large, the verb that stands behind the noun, it's used 26 times in the New Testament. So you have a little bit more room to work with. But there are several of those 26 times that follow the secular concept of hagiazo. And that secular concept was not holiness, not in the typical Christian sense of the term. Because what is holiness in the typical Christian sense of the term? It's moral purity, isn't it? And isn't that even the focus in 1 Thessalonians 4, that this is the will of God, your sanctification, so you need to be aware that you don't get sexually involved in wrong kinds of behavior and become impure, because God's called you to sanctification. He wants you to watch how you handle your body while you're in this world, and don't do stuff to your body that makes you impure. That's the idea of, in a sense, that's the idea of holiness. That's kind of the Christian sense, is to do what's right. But in the secular world, hagiazo was applied to, and I don't want to offend you young people, but you're way ahead of this anyway. I'm just going to say it. It applied to temple prostitutes. In the large cities in the Greek world of the first century, there were many gods, and a lot of those gods had temples. And one of the things of their worship was sexual orgies. And in order to have those, they had to have prostitutes. So that the male and female, so that the people who were worshiping that god could get involved in this worship, they called it. But they called those prostitutes holy. Not in the sense of moral purity, but in the sense that they were dedicated to this god. It was this was their job in life. They were dedicated to this god. So, we read, for example, in Matthew 23, verse 17, where Jesus is jumping down the throats of some of the religious establishment because they're so money hungry, that they think real highly of gold. And he said, "You hypocrites, which is of more value, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold?" Well, which is it? Is the gold more important or is the temple more important? Well, they knew the answer. The temple that sanctifies the gold is far more important than what's sanctified. And then in verse 19, he uses the same idea. When you put a gift on the altar, which is the really significant thing, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? And they knew the answer to that too, was the altar. Because a gift that wasn't placed on the altar didn't have nearly the impact of the gift that was placed on the altar. The gold that was out there in the marketplace didn't have nearly the significance of the gold that was in the sanctuary. Why? Well, I believe that's the idea of the word sanctify. It means that you're given a special status or position or function or something special. You're given an identity that you wouldn't have otherwise. So sanctification has to do with being given a special identity. And in fact, in Acts 20:32 and 26:18, he talks about those who are sanctified. The sanctified. Those who've been given this special identity. And he says that our salvation is tied up in this gaining of this new identity, this sanctification. In other words, the biblical concept of salvation is, as long as you're tied to the old Adam, who sinned in the garden, he passed his sin on to everybody who is out of his genealogical structure. You became a sinner in Adam. And so God said, well, I want to create a new humanity. I'm going to send him another Adam named Jesus, the second Adam. And he's going to produce a whole generation of people who are faith people. They get to participate in what he does by faith. In Adam, you don't have to do anything to participate with him because you're of his genealogy. But since Jesus wasn't talking about physical new birth when he said you have to be born again, he was talking about a special new relationship, and it's called faith. In this text, faith of truth. But the fact is, you have to have this identity. You have to have this new identity. You're either identified with Adam and you're going to perish if you are, and that's the only identity you have. Or you are identified with the old Adam, but you also now, by faith, identified with the new Adam. And being identified with Jesus means you get his perfection, his righteousness, his performance of everything that was required of you. You get it freely. By faith in him, because that's how you get in him. And that's what sanctification is. It's this access to this new identity. And Jesus is the one who sanctifies us, because by being placed in him, we are now the gold in the temple. We're that highly valued commodity that's sanctified by the temple. Jesus is that new temple in that sense. And so what I'm trying to say here is that on the divine side of things, the whole issue of salvation has to do with God bringing us to a new identity. He has to bring us to a new identity. Well, how does he do that? Well, it's called sanctification of spirit. We would translate sanctification of the spirit, because we don't like to talk without definite articles in phrases like this. But nonetheless, it's sanctification of spirit. Well, what does that mean? Well, I told you, the word spirit is in the genitive case. Well, that either means that it's a possession or origin. Now, this is not the Spirit's sanctification. That would be possession. This is sanctification as origin in the work of the Spirit. In other words, the Spirit is the originator of that sanctifying process that brings a person to salvation. And that's exactly what the New Testament teaches us, that we are placed into Christ, called being baptized into the body of Christ by the Spirit of God. He places us into Jesus so that we now have this new identity. I am a child of God because I'm in the Son of God, Jesus himself. It's a spiritual phenomenon, but no, it's very real. The Spirit of God puts you in Jesus. That gives you a new identity. You're now a child of God. That's the divine side. All of the things that God had to do, whether it was orchestrate your thoughts on the back pew of a church or in the surf of the Gulf of Mexico, or some incident in your life that made you start thinking about God, or whatever it was that God had to do that, all of that was being done and orchestrated by the Spirit of God. And he brought you to the point where finally he said, okay, this person's now ready to hear the gospel. And by hearing it, with understanding, you're able then to do your part. His part's been done. He's brought you to a point of clarity of understanding the truth of the gospel. Well, what's your part? Well, according to this text, faith. Your part's to believe it. In other words, God brings you by the Spirit. He brings you to this point where now all of your thinking, all of your emotional preparation, all of that stuff's been done, and he's brought you to this point, and now he explains the gospel to you, that God loves you, he sent his son to die for you. If you'll put your faith in him, he'll give you a new identity, and he'll give you a new destiny, heaven. But that's the gospel, and most people don't understand it. They hear it, and they blow it off. I'm not interested. Well, you know, if you could just fast forward everybody, for just temporarily, if you could fast forward everybody about 200 years into history so that they would have gone through their life and death and their future after death, if you could get that into their thinking somehow, there'd be a lot more people interested in heaven than there are now. Because a lot of people just blow it off. They make stupid statements like, well, when I die, I'm going to go to hell and be with all my friends. That is the dumbest thing that anybody can ever say. Because when you're in hell, you're not going to have any friends. Everybody down there hates everybody else. And not only that, they're in serious pain, and the friends can't help them. There's nothing a friend can do for you when you're in hell. So if you could just fast forward it, that'd solve some of the problems. But nonetheless, on God's side of things, he brings you to this point. Then you hear the gospel, and then this faith of truth comes into play. Now, that means we have to understand what faith is and its relation to truth. We have time for all that? Well, maybe if I talk real fast. What is faith? Well, in the bottom line, faith is an attitude of the heart that simply submits itself to the obvious. In other words, faith is when the heart, recognizing the truth of the gospel, submits to it. Says, yes, I agree. I receive that. I embrace that. I submit to that. That's what faith is. It's not an act of your will. Your will follows the persuasion. I mean, you make your choices based on what you're persuaded is true. And when the Spirit of God brings you to a point where you see the gospel as truth, your will can't help but deal with that. And it's not your will making that the decision. It's not a function of your will. it's not even really a function of your mind. What it really is a function of your soul. Because you are your soul, and in your soul, you have this longing to have everything work out for your best interest. You have this longing for that to happen. And the reasonable thinking of the soul is, if I could just have God on my side so I could have everything that's necessary for my joy, I'd have it made. And here comes the gospel and says, God is willing to make you possessor of the joy of life, but not on the basis of what you want, but on the basis of what God has done for you. And faith says, I'll buy that. The soul is the discerner of the impact of what your mind and your will are involved with. And the faith is also a function of the heart, because it's with the heart that man believes into salvation. But the heart is a repository of your values. And they're always held in tension, and they're always pressing on the soul, because what you want pushes you to want to do things. That's your will being pushed to make these choices. And until you understand exactly what the issues are, sometimes you're pushed in the wrong direction, and that brings us to the word truth. It's faith of truth. In other words, truth is the originator of this faith. And there are a lot of people who believe a lot of stuff that's not true at all. And as a consequence of their faith in lies, they make all kinds of choices and they do all kinds of stupid things. And judgment's waiting for them. It says right there in verse 11 that God will send a deluding influence on them so they'll believe what's false because they did not, according to verse 10, receive the love of the truth and they took pleasure in their unrighteousness. So people that believe lies enjoy their unrighteousness and they have no use for the truth. And it says God's going to judge them. So, truth is both an object of reality and a subject of perception that's impressed on the heart and soul and the mind and the will by the Spirit of God. So that sanctifying activity of the Spirit brings you to this point of clarity. And then your response to that point of clarity is to submit to the gospel and receive the life that God has designed for you, the joy of life. And the bottom line is that salvation comes by the mix of the two elements. On God's side is the working of the Spirit to bring everything into play so that there can come this point of clarity in understanding the gospel with the desire to have the joy of life. When that's all come together, the human part of that is to yield to it. So, on the human side, you just yield to what's obvious. God makes it obvious. You yield to it. That raises a huge issue, and that's, well, how come what's obvious to one person is not obvious to another? Well, you remember when we were talking about the immensity of the universe? Nobody comes to grips with what's obvious by mental or experiential bases. What you think is obvious isn't obvious to me at all. What I think is obvious isn't obvious to you at all. Because we have different backgrounds intellectually and experientially and all those kind of things. So if God's going to call us to yield to the obvious, whose job is it to make something obvious? The omniscient God, who knows exactly how to work in all of our background and all of our thinking, all of our emotional reaction, all of that stuff. He knows exactly how to do that so that there comes this point of clarity coupled with desire for the joy of life. And when that happens, faith is the next thing. And that's how it works. That's what verse 13 says. You, Thessalonians, beloved by God, were chosen by Him from the beginning, and then He subjected you to all of this stuff. And part of that stuff was verse 14. It was for this He called you through our gospel. In other words, He got Paul to go to Thessalonica and tell him the truth. Paul wasn't really inclined to go to Thessalonica before he went. When he was in Asia Minor, he planned to go off somewhere up that way. And the Spirit of God said, no, you're not going up that way. So Paul said, well, then I'll go this way. No, you're not going that way. Well, where am I going to go? He went to sleep. While he was asleep, he had a dream. There was a guy over there saying, come over and help us. And he said, now I know where I'm supposed to go. So he got up and he went there. And that's where Thessalonica turned out to be. So So God was working all this time to bring these people beloved by him to a point where they could understand and believe the truth. And I think that's what verse 13 is driving at.